This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
The other day, I was struck with the notion that it's virtually impossible that in some sense things aren't the way Shakyamuni Buddha perceived them to be. And that's not a sectarian claim. I do not mean it as such. Virtually all spiritual traditions that have any vitality to them suggest in one way or another that what meets the eye, but it's more like the story, the commonly accepted story about what meets the eye is not the whole story. So maybe especially nowadays, it's pretty common for us to feel the weight, the burden of what we think of as our human condition. Ever since folks like the existentialists came up with this, some catchy little phrases like, how do we live in an absurd and heartless universe? Which is like, well, there's a great way to make people feel, you know, happy about being alive. And of course, that is primarily it's an intellectual construct that leaves the body behind. And this is the case with a great deal of Western philosophy. Very elaborate and powerful thinking has gone into European philosophical traditions and now in the United States as well. But very often the body is left out. And for that reason, the picture that emerges feels very incomplete, at least to me. So I was crossing the street over there at Market in Noe, and I stopped. Fortunately, the light was green for me, and it was, it was very clear that the powerful life represented by all of these people walking around did not rest on sovereign individual identity. It simply didn't, can't. again, that wasn't a, it doesn't feel to me like a sectarian claim. Other faith traditions may put it differently. But the notion of the isolated individual suspended in uncaring space is simply a modern nightmare, conjured from the fevered thinking of various Frenchmen and a few French women. So, you know, this is a great relief to know that you do not have to participate in that nightmare if you don't want to. It's unfortunate that I think some of those French folks pointed to Buddha Dharma and said, see, they say everything's empty, and they are right. It's just so empty. It's like they didn't get it at all. So to be actually alive, to actually exist, is to be empty. Empty just means no stopping place. And our sitting practice is really wonderful for introducing us over and over again to that fluidity. And little by little, the grip that the nightmare has on us loosens. Because I think it does, it's got a pretty good grip on us. But still, even in the East, it's not as though Buddha's teaching was, it's really hard for Westerners and it's really easy for Easterners. It's like, no, that's not true. That pretty much humans everywhere have some trouble with it. So in India, there was considerable resistance from certain quarters. And personally, I think some of the people who were rejecting Buddha's insight didn't actually understand it. And in fact, I thought that Buddha was teaching something like nihilism. He wasn't at all. It's, in any case, it's difficult to get these teachings across in such a way that the nightmare intellect isn't constantly just batting them away. Oh, that can't be true. No, that's not right. We are alone in an absurd universe. Maybe some of you have seen that great online comic strip, Existential Comics. It's delightful. And the masthead, he says something like, comic strip about being alive in an absurd and careless universe. Also jokes. I love that comic strip. I don't know the author, obviously, but maybe he may have a good take on things. So in China, as far as I can tell, they didn't go in so much for jokes, at least. There was a certain amount of joking around, but generally the teaching tends to be presented in a fairly, especially in Chan, of course, a very intense and pungent way. And one reason that is done is because otherwise the intellect will start to fiddle with it and turn it into something it's not. So the Chanists over there in China, the Zenists in Japan, they too were using Buddha's teaching to dissolve the bonds of the nightmare. And one of the things they recognized was that the nightmare, as kind of I've been saying, is rooted in language. It's a, as is the case with most spells, the power is vested in certain words and in their repetition over and over again. So Chan developed some ways of getting around that. Although if I say developed, it doesn't mean somebody didn't sit down and try and figure out how to do it. It just kind of happened. And that's why so many of our Zen Chan campfire tales have this peculiar they're so intuitive that they come across as counterintuitive. Because they're not so much speaking to hear, although there's nothing wrong with the mind or the brain. They're speaking to hear, or often enough, hear. So if you cultivate a while, sometimes when you encounter the teaching, you'll notice that they're hitting you here. Or here. Not so much here. And they turned some of these linguistic counterspells into poetry much of the time. One of our ancestors, or at least as we tell the story, was a fellow named Kanadeva. Depending how you parse that compound, it could mean something like a blind god. It's an odd expression. Anyway, he was the student and heir of the great Acharya Nagarjuna. And at some point, I I guess he encountered Nagarjuna or heard Nagarjuna was in town, so he came to see him. And when he went in to have a visit, he brought a bowl of water. So like a water offering. And there was a kind of symbolic resonance to that gesture. So he puts the water bowl down in front of Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna looks at it, and then he looks around, and there's some of his sewing was next to him, so he took a needle and dropped it in the water. This was that was actually a Chan dialogue right there. And Kanadeva got it. To the extent that he thought, yeah, I'm gonna hang out with this guy. So water, you know, you could say, the symbolic, what have we been reading about? Oh, the Dogen's essay, the ocean seal, the ocean mudra, samadhi. So sort of like, here, Nagarjuna, here's an ocean of samadhi. And Nagarjuna maybe thought that was pretty good. And he takes this needle and drops it in the water. I think, he was suggesting that Kanadeva's gesture was pretty good, but there's actually room for something else. Or you could say it was a question. So, Kanadeva, I dropped this needle in your water. Is there anywhere in your apprehension of the teaching that I could even fit a needle into? And I think he was suggesting, yes, there was a gap there somewhere, but that he would be happy to work with Kanadeva until Kanadeva understood the meaning of no gap. So he was, Kanadeva was the, I forget now, 17th or something, ancestor, Indian ancestor. And many, oh, many, many, many generations later, there was a Chinese master named Ba Ling, who is a disciple of Yunnan, another very, very a towering figure in Chan. And something possessed one of his students or monastics to ask him, what is the school of Kanadeva? At least in this story, it's not clear why he picked on Kanadeva at that particular moment. Perhaps he'd just been reading Zen tales and had read about Kanadeva. But so he asks Ba Ling, what is the school of Kanadeva? And Kanadeva says, snow in a silver bowl. And you may recognize that phrase from one of our great treasures of Zen poetry, the Baojing Sanneke, the Song of the Precious Mirror Samadhi. So snow in a silver bowl. So you probably should have some context for that. And the poem, the Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, says, snow in a silver bowl, a heron standing in the moonlight, if you take them as identical, they're not. In other words, snow, bowl, heron, moon, they're not identical. Take them separately, mix them up, you can see them clearly. So, in other words, they're reflected in this precious mirror. There is both unity and multiplicity. So, in this very terse way, Ba Ling explains to the monastic about the school of Kanadeva, an image that is both unity and diversity. Now, Kanadeva seems to have been a kind of odd bird. During his day, as I think has been the case in India for millennia, the tradition of various philosophical viewpoints engaging with each other in dialogue and debate and so forth was very well established. And in Kanadeva's time, he had encountered another group that disagreed with his point of view. So the tradition would have been to have a debate. But the so-called the heretics, the people outside the way, decided they didn't want to do that. And so in the monastic compound, there's a one-story tower with the bell. And the debate would be announced by ringing the bell. So the head heretic blocked the door so that no one could go in there and ring the bell. So Kanadeva used his spiritual power to float up to the bell and rang it anyway. So the head heretic hears that, furious, comes storming over and says, "Who rang that bell?" And Kanadeva answers, "A deva." In other words, a god. And the heretic says, "Who's a god?" And Kanadeva says, "I." The heretic says, "Who's I?" And Kanadeva says, "You is a dog." Now, This is not like urban speak. Okay, you is a dog. It's like you, quote unquote, is a dog. And the heretic says, who's a dog? And Kanadeva says, the dog is you. So apparently this went on for quite a while. And the head heretic finally gives up and says, you know what, you win. So Kanadeva comes floating down. The winner gets to hold a red flag over the head of the loser. So he did that, which caused the that whole heretical group to become his disciple. So they all shaved their heads and became bhikshus and probably bhikshunis. So whether the monastic who was talking to the Baling was talking about that story, I don't know. It doesn't say. But it does make the assertion that the school of Kanadeva is our school, has been one school since way back then. And Ba Ling was famous for using very precise needle-like expressions to puncture the bubble of nightmare. The nightmare of eternal, separate, isolated existence. So, as I said, he was the Dharma heir of the great Yunlun, and he had a visit with Yunlun once, and Yunlun had three questions for him. And one was, so what is the way? With a capital W. Ba Ling says, a clear-eyed person falls in a well. Yunlun nodded. And he said, what is the blown hair sword? And Ba Ling said, each branch of coral supports the moon. Now, the blown hair sword is a Chinese trope, a sword that is so sharp that if a breeze carried a hair against the blade, it would cut. And it's also an image for the mind that travels into reality without touching anything. And lastly, Yunlun asks Ba Ling, what is the school of Kanadeva? And Ba Ling says, snow in a silver bowl. And ever after, Ba Ling used these three expressions to free people. So maybe you don't feel free this morning. That doesn't mean you're not. But I wouldn't go looking for a feeling of freedom. Or if you want that, try yoga or something. Or go for a walk at the beach. But Shakyamuni Buddha's freedom isn't about a feeling. Ha! It's about snow in a silver bowl. So as you're out and about today, see if you can find some durable contradiction of Shakyamuni Buddha's teaching. And if you do, I'd like it if you'd come and tell me about it. In the meantime, you should enjoy your freedom that you cannot grasp. And let that freedom be a solvent for the nightmare that so many of us suffer from. And you won't know how that works, but that's okay. Yes, sir. The hammering means it's time to stop. Because I asked those guys, did you keep quiet between 9:30 and 11? And they said yes. Shocked me. But maybe we can mix hammering with questions if you have any. Yes.
I can't help but wonder if that metaphor, for lack of a better term, of the needle in the bowl of water somehow includes the idea that way back when, to put a metal needle in a bowl of water was to, it acted as a compass. Mm-hmm.
If it's a magnetized needle, yes. I think I wondered about that too. But when I was a Boy Scout, we did that. But we would put a little piece of paper towel first in the water. Because otherwise, it was very likely that the needle would sink. Mm-hmm. So we put the piece of paper towel, and then, you know, you magnetize half the needle, just one half. You put it down, and sure enough, it's a compass. So, yeah, in a way, it's a compass. But maybe not in quite that way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it does show true north. You're right.
I wasn't quite clear what you said when you opened. Did you say you were in the street and you saw this wasn't Shakyamuni Buddha's teachings? Did I mishear you?
What I hoped I was saying was that there was no way that Shakyamuni Buddha's teachings weren't true.
Oh, weren't true.
Were not true.
Okay, I misheard you.
No. Oh, sorry.
That's a nice thing to have in the middle of Market Street.
Yeah. As I said, I did pause and notice that the light was changing. Otherwise, I might not be here to tell you about it. Did you have a question? Yes.
Well, thank you, first of all. This is what I needed to hear this morning. I guess I had a sort of a different reaction to the needle in the water, mm-hmm. Which, you know, maybe I just see what you think about, mm-hmm. which is that the needle now is not being used.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly not, I mean, you would have to dry it off to make it back into a sewing needle.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so useful in the water. And it struck me as maybe it was and it might not be where the teaching was going, but was almost like a submission.
Mm.
When I drop something into water, I once had to leave an organization, never mind, and I had this kind of membership coin. I threw it into the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a mutuality about that.
Well, listening to you, what occurs to me is that it was possibly in a similar sense to what you're saying, it was an invitation.
Mm-hmm.
So in that regard, yeah, I think that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.